As we wrap up our May theme of blessing on this Memorial Day weekend with the words of that beautiful song ringing in our ears and in our hearts, it seems fitting to acknowledge that for some Americans, as for those who serve in any voluntary military anywhere in the world, having all they ever wanted meant a military career, and that for some of them, it ended in the somber tune of taps, as described in this morning's reading. My father was in the Air Force for 24 years, including all of my childhood. He was accepted into the Air Force Academy, actually, and only a leg badly broken in a skiing accident his senior year of high school kept him from being able to follow that dream, sending him instead to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where he was in the ROTC, the Reserve Officer Training Corps, and where he met my mother on a blind date in his sophomore year. I guess I should be thankful for that broken leg. He retired the same summer that I graduated for college for the first time. I proudly wore the label military brat through all those years, one of those terms that only we could apply to ourselves and have it be okay. And that label is still part of what defines who I am as an adult. For former military brats, or current military brats for that matter, TAPS was just something you heard at the end of the day if you were on base, along with reveille in the morning and retreat at the end of the workday in the early evening. We knew it would happen each night, the same way we knew that movies at the base theater started with us standing, hands over hearts, for the national anthem. More than once, a military brat has stood and done this at the beginning of a movie in a civilian theater to funny looks from the rest of the crowd. It's one of the markers of being a military brat. Now, I didn't live on base for most of my childhood, but for some of my friends who did, hearing taps meant come home, it's bedtime, on weekends and during the summer break from school. I don't remember that we children connected hearing taps with the death of military service members at all, at least not until the first time we encountered that image, usually in a movie that we went to see at that theater. We were lucky, blessed even, growing up in an era during which the United States was at peace. My father was active duty military from 1968 to 1992. Most of my childhood fell neatly into the time frame between the end of the war in Vietnam, Saigon fell just days after my fourth birthday, and the beginning of the first war in Iraq, which started when I was an undergraduate. My father was never deployed, never in combat, never in mortal risk, as far as I know, at least not any more than the rest of us. I don't know that I was even aware that we were at war during my earliest childhood years, and I have no personal memories of how shamefully we treated our veterans returning from Vietnam, and no childhood memories of military funerals. I grew up with some understanding, of course, of my father's career. I understood that if we went to war against the Soviet Union, our presumed enemy in that era, he was one of the people who might launch a missile at them. I also grew up with a sort of morbid awareness that living near military installations meant we lived in high-risk areas if the Russians ever did decide to launch missiles at us. We sometimes guessed how many minutes it would be between the sirens and the actual arrival of the missiles. Like I said, kind of morbid. There were even movies in my teenage years about the threat of war with the Soviet Union. Red Dawn, War Games, Top Gun. Some of you might be just the right age to have seen those in your teens as well. What I didn't grow up with, though, was the fear of my father being sent away to war, or that he would die carrying out his commitment to our country. Now, that was mostly because, as I said, we were at peace, and any war other than the Cold War was only a distant threat to us. It was also because of my dad's particular job, sometimes working in underground missile launch control facilities, and sometimes in the airborne command post called Looking Glass, which I knew was always in flight, There was more than one plane, of course, out of different bases and flying different shifts, but it was always in flight in case our ground bases were ever destroyed. My father wasn't in harm's way in the same way that the soldiers of the war in Vietnam, the Korean War, which I mostly knew through the television series MASH, or either of the world wars had been. War, if it happened in my generation, seemed likely to happen remotely, with missiles launched and no ground combat. It felt like either we were all safe or no one on the planet was. Military families weren't at any more risk than the average civilian. Even that threat of a presumably Soviet missile attack was so remote that my experience of my dad's military career was mostly about him being gone approximately the same hours as business people, but wearing a uniform instead of a suit. Occasional shifts during which he was on alert on base for a few days at a stretch, where we could still visit him with a picnic lunch. And of course, the frequent moves our family and others I knew made from one base to another throughout his career. Things have changed in the decades since my childhood, though. I've now watched my niece and nephew have a very different experience of what it means to be a military brat, as my brother serves in the Marine Corps in an era not at all like our own childhood. On September 11th, 2001, my niece was in kindergarten in Yuma, Arizona, where my brother was stationed at the Marine Corps Air Station. By January of 2002, he had deployed to Afghanistan for what would be the first of many tours of duty there and in Iraq. My sister-in-law was at that time in the middle of a very difficult pregnancy, which had her more or less bedridden, and so she couldn't care for my niece without help. I was single and self-employed and childless, so I went to be the stand-in second parent in my brother's place while he was deployed. I still remember the red, white, and blue paper chains hung to look like an American flag on their living room wall, thanks to my creative sister-in-law. My niece got to cut one of those loops off every day, counting down the days until her daddy would be home. She did it with such certainty that when the last loop was gone, he'd be there. Meanwhile, my sister-in-law and I never spoke of the fact that his return date was a guess at best, and that there was a chance he might not return at all. We certainly didn't talk about the fact that he'd be deployed again and again and again, that he'd earn a Bronze Star in Fallujah, and that we wouldn't want to know the story behind the V for Valor on that medal. In adulthood, I hear taps and think not of something routine, but of military funerals. And I think it could be my father, my brother, either of two sister-in-laws, my uncle, or my son's father that was being laid to rest to those notes. They bring tears to my eyes in a way they never did when I heard them on base during my childhood. When I was earning a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, I wrote a thesis project called Military Brat, an Encyclopedia of Location and Dislocation. Dislocation. That was the trauma, and I'm going to put that in quotes, that was the trauma of my military childhood. And it seemed big at the time, picking up and moving every few years, leaving everything familiar behind except for my family and what possessions we took with us. But now, as in previous eras of our national history, the traumas of a military childhood can include enduring long separations from one or sometimes both parents, having a parent return from a deployment with physical and/or psychological injuries, or having a parent killed in the line of duty. Now, some part of us knows that this is the reality our military families live with. We see news coverage every now and then about a unit deploying or returning, or a story about wounded veterans. They're usually triumphal stories. We don't hear as much as we did a decade ago, even about those stories, and we almost never hear about the suicides, about the lack of care for many of our wounded warriors, or about the isolation that families feel during deployments. We, as a nation, seem not to have a stomach for those stories anymore. And I want us to recognize that it is privilege if we are able to choose when or if to think of them. I wonder, are we, Unitarian Universalists in general, any different from our larger society when it comes to this? Except for congregations in areas with large military installations, think of San Diego, California, or Norfolk, Virginia, for example, Unitarian Universalists tend not to think about ministering to military members and their families. I believe we are more welcoming of military families than we were during the Vietnam era, when we saw our peace activism as inherently at conflict with anyone in the military. Or even in the 1980s of my own childhood, when some people at our church did question how someone like my father could be both military and Unitarian Universalist, affirming values like the inherent worth and dignity of every person. I wish that I had known back then that in addition to our long, long tradition of standing for peace, we also have a long tradition of supporting our military. I wish I had known then that our famous forebear, John Murray, was one of the chaplains for George Washington's army during the Revolutionary War, and that we have a long, proud tradition of Unitarian Universalist military chaplaincy ever since then. I often wonder what it might have been like for my family if at any of the places where we were stationed that did not have a Unitarian Universalist congregation within a reasonable drive, and there were many of those places, what would it have been like if the chaplain on base had been a Unitarian Universalist? Those chaplains, like our civilian ministers, do more than lead worship and provide pastoral care, though they certainly do both of those things. They also speak out against injustices, even when those injustices are found within the very military they serve. Just recently, for example, one of our military chaplains resigned his commission in the Army in protest over drone warfare. But it's not just our clergy who are serving this country in the military. We do have military families in our churches, whether we know it or not. In the church where I was a member before coming to Colorado, we had no active duty members. We weren't near a large base. But the son of a member of the church was deployed multiple times, and she and I commiserated over the worry experienced by family members when their loved ones are at war. Her son's photographs of Afghan and Iraqi children and her poetry about the war hung in an exhibit in that church's main hallway for a while. She and I had many conversations about her son and my brother and their safety. Those conversations ultimately led me to another graduate school writing project called We Also Serve: Stories from American Military Families. I used to joke that I would never join the military because the Air Force got the first 18 years of my life, and that was enough. Of course, I wasn't really joking. Now, of course, I know that being a family member is not the same thing as being in the military. But when I see what the lives of spouses and children in military families today often look like, I hope that we will never forget the sacrifices that they are making. As a minister, I wonder, how can I serve those families without serving in the military? Because I'm still pretty clear on that point, that they've had enough of my time. I'm not called to military chaplaincy, nor am I particularly called to serve in a location with a huge military population. If I do, great. If not, that's okay too. But there are military people scattered all across this country, and some of them, like my family, find their way into our congregations. Do we welcome them? Not just on the first day they come when we greet them as warmly as any visitor, but on days like this one, and on all the days when we make comments sharing our opinions about what uses our military is being put to or how much of our national budget it costs? Are they welcome on those days? I believe this is one of our blind spots, similar to how we may assume that there are no politically conservative members in our religiously liberal congregations, or how we may assume that because our denomination in general is highly educated and earning high salaries, that that's true of everyone in our churches. We often think that this is a place full of people like us. Not in every detail, of course, but enough like us that we make assumptions like the ones I just mentioned. My dad, at the end of his life, chose to have a celebration of his life at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where he and Mom had belonged for a number of years. He chose that instead of a military funeral. Not because the military wasn't important to him, but because it hadn't defined him for some time. Many of his closest military friends were with us there for that celebration, some of them seeing for the first time how his military identity and his Unitarian Universalist faith could indeed fit together. He wasn't the only one with both of those identities. Our church happens not to be near a military base, so we may not have active duty service members in our congregation. But what about reservists? What about military spouses or ex-spouses raising the children of a military service member? What about retired military, including veterans of current and past wars? Do you know who in this congregation has served in the military? I'm going to ask a voluntary activity. I never force participation, but I would be curious to know how many of us in this room this morning served or currently serve in the military in one way or another. Thank you. And how many of you have an immediate family member who does or has served in the military? Look around for a minute, friends. We're almost all military families if we look just a little bit further out. What I can nearly guarantee is that each one of us in this room, whether we raised our hands just now or not, know and love someone who has served in our nation's military, and perhaps someone who has died in the course of that service. I can tell you that from that perspective, Memorial Day is not just about picnics and flags on lawns and patriotic music and a day off of school or work on Monday. It's about honoring those who we've lost. Let us remember them all, not just today and on the 4th of July and on Veterans Day, when being publicly patriotic is what we do, but every day. May we remember that they or their loved ones may come here, do come here, as we've just shown, seeking the same things that we do, and seeking to serve here as well, in ways different from their military service, but just as important to them, and just as potentially transformative for us as a community. Let us recognize and welcome them for the blessings that they are. Amen.